So picture this. You've got two expert investors, right? And they are standing on a sidewalk looking at the exact same brick-and-mortar building.
Right, same building, same street.
Exactly. The spreadsheet hasn't changed, the street traffic is the same, but one investor sees, like, guaranteed millions, a total gold mine, and the other, they see a flashing red warning sign and just walk away.
Yeah, they run for the hills.
Right. So what did change? I mean, today we are tearing down the myth of the perfect real estate asset because, you know, you would think that a truly good investment is just objectively obvious to anyone paying attention, right?
Oh, absolutely. It
Well,
is
no.
this massive, incredibly common misconception that veteran investors possess some kind of crystal ball.
Like they just know.
Exactly. People assume the pros can just predict the market better than the rest of us, or that they have this secret formula for finding an entirely flawless asset. But let's be real, flawless properties do not exist.
Just don't.
No, every single opportunity, no matter how shiny it looks, comes with a mixed bag of strengths, weaknesses, and hidden liabilities. So what separates those two investors on the sidewalk isn't a crystal ball, it is a framework.
A framework.
Yeah, property valuation is ultimately about identifying which of those underlying mechanics are genuinely going to matter over a long period of time.
And that framework is exactly what we are going to build today. Welcome to today's deep dive, everyone. Our mission is to unpack this specific analytical framework so that you, listening right now, can evaluate properties with absolute confidence.
Because it's so easy to get distracted.
Oh, incredibly easy to get blinded by a beautiful spreadsheet. We know you follow the markets, but we are taking a stack of source insights today and distilling them down to the absolute essentials. And the beauty of this framework is that it holds up whether you are looking to purchase a traditional commercial property outright, or you're exploring modern avenues like fractional property ownership in Saudi Arabia.
Which is huge right now. But to build that framework, we actually have to start in a place that frustrates a lot of people.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, because if you are setting out to evaluate a building, your natural instinct is to immediately pull up listings,
Yeah.
right? You want to start analyzing the architecture, the foot traffic, the asking price.
Okay, let's unpack this because the first step in this framework is what our sources call the mirror method, meaning before you analyze a building's foundation, you have to analyze your own financial foundation.
Yes, exactly.
We are moving away from the physical property entirely for a moment. It's like browsing property listings first is like buying a highly rated pair of running shoes without knowing if you are running a marathon or attending a gala.
That's a great way to put it. And the sources point out a trap that even seasoned veteran investors fall into, which is goal amnesia.
Goal amnesia. I love that term.
It's a perfect term for it. You start out looking for one thing, but you get seduced by a listing that promises something completely different. Because the word best in investing is wildly subjective.
Right.
The best investment does not objectively mean the one with the highest projected return. It means the one that mathematically aligns with your specific goals. Our sources break down four distinct investor profiles, and mixing them up is, well, it's financially lethal.
So let's frame those profiles for everyone, not as like a beginner's guide, but as a reminder of where the blind spots are. Because if you don't anchor yourself to what you are trying to achieve, you can't judge if an asset is a genuine fit or just, you know, superficially appealing.
Okay, let's look at the friction between income generation and long-term growth. If your goal is income generation, your entire thesis relies on stable, unexciting rental demand and highly reliable cash flow.
You need that check clearing every month.
Right, you need a property that puts money in your pocket every 30 days. But if your goal is long-term growth, you might deliberately accept negative cash flow for 5 years.
Wait, deliberately losing money.
Yeah. Because you are buying into an area with massive development potential where the actual capital value will skyrocket later. Those two goals are fundamentally at war with each other.
That makes total sense. And take that a step further with capital preservation versus diversification. I mean, if you are a capital preservation investor, your only mandate is not losing the money you already have.
Exactly. You want to sleep at night.
Right. You are pointing yourself toward lower risk, highly established locations. You are happily accepting lower yields in exchange for that peace of mind.
And that is where the goal amnesia kicks in. Let's say you are that capital preservation investor. You have your mandate. But then you read an article about a high-risk, high-reward industrial park in a completely undeveloped neighborhood that is supposed to be the next big thing.
Oh boy.
You buy it because the math looked pretty on paper. Well, you
Yeah.
have just bought a heavy-duty pickup truck for a Formula One race. It's a fundamental mechanical mismatch.
Which brings up an interesting shift in the modern landscape. With modern tools like fractional ownership and developing markets, investors now have access to asset classes and geographic regions they previously just couldn't touch.
Oh, easily.
Like, you can buy a slice of a massive commercial high-rise from your phone right now. Doesn't that make having this strict mirror framework more important, not less?
Oh, it acts as an absolute multiplier for these blind spots. When the barrier to entry drops, the temptation to stray from your core strategy skyrockets.
Because it's so easy.
Right. Just because you can buy a fraction of a logistics center doesn't mean it serves your portfolio's mandate.
Mm.
Good investors do not start with the platform or the listings. They start with the mirror.
Okay, so once you have looked in that mirror and you know what your specific financial problem is, you turn your attention to the building. And that brings us to the next structural question, which is, what problem is the property solving for the people who will actually use it?
And this raises an important point, especially for those who, you know, live in the data, because it is incredibly tempting to stop your analysis at the financial spreadsheet.
Actually, I have to push back here for a second, just playing devil's advocate. If I am looking at a property and the spreadsheet says it is generating massive income right now, isn't it obviously solving a problem? I mean, the money is changing hands. Why do I need to overthink the philosophy of the building?
What's fascinating here is that we consistently confuse the symptom with the cause.
Okay, how so?
Well, financial metrics, the rent being paid, the quarterly cash flow, those are merely the result of fundamental demand. They are the symptom. The cause is the human behavior driving that demand.
I see.
As an investor, you have to understand the mechanical difference between resilient demand, which is built on genuine structural fundamentals, and fragile demand, which is driven by temporary cultural trends or market enthusiasm.
So resilient versus fragile demand. Let's dig into the mechanics of that. Give me a scenario where fragile demand just completely collapses.
Okay, think of a commercial property in a neighborhood that is only popular right now because a famous influencer opened a trendy experiential retail space there.
Oh, right, like a pop-up museum or something.
Exactly. The foot traffic is astronomical. The rental yields look incredible on your spreadsheet today. But the demand is fragile because it is entirely dependent on consumer sentiment, which shifts like the wind.
The trend dies.
The moment that trend dies or a cooler spot opens across town, the foot traffic vanishes. The commercial tenants can't pay their inflated rent, and your spreadsheet completely collapses.
Contrast that with resilient demand from our sources. What does that look like?
Resilient demand is baked into human necessity. For residential properties, that means proximity to immovable necessities, major transport arteries, comprehensive healthcare facilities, established employment centers.
The boring stuff.
The boring stuff. People will always need a reasonable commute. They will always need hospitals. For commercial properties, resilient demand looks like accessibility, high visibility, and positioning within a geographically constrained, growing business district. You're looking for a property that encourages people to choose it over every alternative simply because it is mechanically easier for their daily lives.
And our source text provides a brilliant stress test for this. It's called the 5-year beginner test. Have you seen this?
Yes, it's such a great tool.
Here's how it works for you listening.
Yeah.
Imagine explaining this specific real estate investment to someone with zero financial or real estate experience. Could you clearly explain to them why someone would want to live there, work there, or rent that space 5 years from now without using any future economic assumptions or general market hype?
It is brilliant because it forces you to strip away the jargon.
Right.
If your explanation requires a lot of, well, if this new tech conglomerate moves their headquarters, or if the regional zoning laws change in our favor, you are not investing. You are relying on hope.
Just crossing your finger.
Exactly. The strongest, most resilient investments are rarely the most complicated. They're the ones where the reasons for demand are boring, obvious, and supported by factors that will objectively remain relevant for a decade.
But because that beginner test relies so much on logic and behavioral observation, we have to be really careful not to swing too far the other way and ignore the math entirely. Which brings us to the illusion of headline numbers.
The numbers are critical. Let's not pretend they aren't. But they are starting points, not conclusions. They require interrogation.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because judging an investment solely by its current rental yield is like judging a car's health by only looking at the speedometer.
Oh, I love that analogy.
Right. Like, sure, you're going 80 miles an hour right now, but it tells you absolutely nothing about whether the engine is about to explode. let's pull up the dashboard and debate these metrics, starting with occupancy rate. Take a building that's 100% full, the occupancy rate is maxed out. How could that possibly be a bad thing? You cannot fake bodies in a building.
You can't fake the bodies, no. But you absolutely can fake the financial stability keeping them there.
Wait, really? How?
This is a classic trap. A building might be fully occupied today because the landlord is offering massive, entirely unsustainable rent discounts to keep tenants in month-to-month leases just so they can sell the building with a fully occupied headline.
Oh, wow. So they are just juicing the stats.
Exactly. The occupancy rate looks flawless, but the underlying lease structure is a house of cards. It completely ignores long-term demand trends.
That makes perfect sense. Let's look at another one, rental yield. I mean, this is the golden calf of property investing. It shows the current income relative to the property's price. If the yield is sky high, isn't that the definition of a good deal?
Not necessarily. A highly inflated rental yield today could actually be a glaring warning sign that the underlying property value is stagnating or even dropping.
Because it's a ratio.
Yes. If the denominator, the property value, shrinks because the neighborhood is deteriorating, the yield percentage artificially inflates. You think you are buying a cash cow, but you are actually catching a falling knife. It tells you nothing about future growth prospects.
What about straight rental income, like the actual gross cash hitting the bank account every single month?
That reflects existing performance. But again, look at the mechanics. If 80% of that rental income is coming from employees of a single dominant manufacturing plant in that town, and that plant decides to offshore its operations,
your rental income vanishes overnight.
Poof. Gone. The spreadsheet yesterday cannot guarantee the sustainability of tomorrow.
And then you have the raw property value, the current market position,
which tells you what someone was willing to pay yesterday. It tells you nothing about future appreciation potential. A sky-high property value in a highly publicized neighborhood might mean the asset has already peaked. The growth is done.
So if looking at the Friday afternoon sales is a trap, what is the actual mechanism we should be using to read these numbers?
Contextual convergence.
Contextual convergence.
Yeah, there is a great source article we have titled, "What is Rental Yield and Why Does It Matter to Property Investors?" It stresses that the most compelling opportunities don't just have one flashy metric. They have multiple boring factors pointing in the exact same direction.
Right, they stack up.
Yeah. A property generating moderate but reliable income, located in an area with genuinely resilient demand, supported by immovable infrastructure, presents a much stronger mechanical case than a property boasting a 12% yield but failing on every long-term fundamental.
Okay, so if the numbers are deceptive when viewed in isolation, we have to talk about location. Because everyone knows the cliche, right? Location, location, location. Location dictates the demand, which dictates the numbers. But the way the industry talks about location is often completely backward.
It is arguably the most misunderstood concept we're covering today.
I'm going to throw the most classic real estate strategy at you. Buying the worst house in the most fashionable, highly talked about neighborhood, you get in cheap, and the sheer popularity of the location carries your asset's value upward. It's considered a guaranteed win.
It sounds incredibly smart in theory, but mechanically, it frequently fails.
Really? Why?
Because highly fashionable areas, the ones dominating the real estate blogs and dinner party conversations, have often already experienced their exponential growth. The obvious opportunity is already priced into the property value.
Ah, the secret is already out.
Exactly. If you buy the worst asset on the best street, you are still paying a massive premium just for the zip code. Popularity is the lagging indicator. Investment potential is the leading indicator.
Because if everyone already knows about it, the market has efficiently adjusted the price. You aren't discovering anything, you're just paying retail.
Precisely the opposite of finding value. Experienced investors focus far less on current fashion and heavily on the underlying drivers that force long-term performance. Things like population migration data, corporate employment shifts, and massive government infrastructure investments.
Which brings up a really fascinating application of this entire framework, specifically looking at the evolving real estate market in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, Saudi Arabia is a prime example of this mechanic in action. The country is experiencing massive systemic economic development across multiple regions. Entirely new economic zones are being established as we speak.
Right. It's moving so fast.
It is. But the challenge for investors looking at that market isn't just pointing at the most famous city center and buying whatever's available.
Right. Because that's just buying the current popularity. The real skill is identifying the areas benefiting from sustainable structural growth before they reach mass market saturation.
You have to look at the unglamorous data. Where are the new municipal transit lines actually breaking ground? Where are the long-term corporate headquarters physically laying foundations?
The boring things again.
Always the boring things. You're looking for the fundamentals that will inevitably manufacture popularity tomorrow. Understanding why a location will attract people over the next 10 years is exponentially more valuable than simply knowing that a different location is crowded today.
Which leads us to a realization that is, honestly, a bit counterintuitive. If true fundamental value comes from an unexciting location with solid contextual metrics solving a very clear everyday problem for its tenants, that usually results in something highly reliable. And highly reliable things are rarely thrilling.
No, they are not. In fact, executed correctly, good investing is remarkably boring.
So what does this all mean for everyone listening? We've talked about the heavy lifting required here. Analyzing your own biases, proving resilient demand, ignoring flashy spreadsheet numbers, discounting current hype. What if an investor doesn't want to buy an entire logistics center? Is fractional ownership a structural shortcut around doing all this rigorous homework?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we have to look at investor psychology. We are naturally drawn to excitement. We want the compelling story to tell at a dinner party.
Of course we do.
But resilience punishes speculation over the long run. And to answer your question about fractional platforms, no, it is absolutely not a shortcut.
Let's really clarify the mechanics of that, because the fractional market is exploding right now.
It is. But when you evaluate fractional property ownership, the analytical process is identical to a traditional purchase. You are still buying physical real estate.
Right.
The structural fundamentals that make a commercial space attractive do not magically change just because the equity is split among 1,000 people instead of held by one entity.
So the fractional platform lowers the financial barrier, but it doesn't do the due diligence for you.
It removes the logistical burden of managing my asset, sure, but it does not remove the need for analysis. The underlying concrete and glass is still the foundation of your capital. You still have to run the 5-year beginner test. You still have to ask if the yield is an illusion.
Our sources highlight two specific articles on this. One is Understanding Fractional Property Ownership in Saudi Arabia, and the other is How Saudi Investors Can Own Fractional Shares in Real Estate. Both of them drive home this central principle. The vehicle you use to buy the asset doesn't change the quality of the asset.
And this brings us to the operational side of platforms facilitating this. The sources mention Osul Gamma, which is currently operating within RGA's regulatory sandbox in Saudi Arabia.
Just to pause there for a second, for those who aren't familiar, RGA is Saudi Arabia's real estate general authority. And a regulatory sandbox is essentially a safe, controlled testing ground where new financial platforms can operate under strict government supervision before rolling out to the general public, right?
That is correct. It ensures these platforms meet rigorous standards. And Osul Gamma's core philosophy aligns perfectly with the framework we are building today. They operate on the premise that genuine wealth is built on transparent information and deep investor education.
Because if you are just swiping on an app to buy a fractional share without understanding the resilient demand keeping that building alive, you aren't investing, you're gambling.
Exactly. They are trying to force investors to look at the mechanics, to help individuals navigate these fractional opportunities by making decisions based on actual data rather than digital assumptions.
That's so critical.
It is, because informed investors,
yeah,
the ones who understand how an asset mechanically generates value and what liabilities threaten its performance, those are the only ones positioned to survive market cycles.
Okay, let's bring this all together. Evaluating an investment property, whether you are buying the entire skyscraper downtown or a tiny fraction of an industrial park, is ultimately about reducing uncertainty.
Right. Reducing, not eliminating.
Right. You can never completely eliminate risk. No one has the crystal ball.
Mm.
But you can build a structural framework of evidence that overpowers mere optimism. You have to analyze your own strategic mandate first so you don't suffer from goal amnesia.
Yes.
You have to test the property to see if it solves a genuine, structurally resilient problem for the people using it. You have to cross-reference the flashy headline numbers to find the underlying truth. And you have to realize that sustainable future potential is mathematically more valuable than current cultural popularity.
You don't have to be the genius who is the very first to discover a hidden geographical opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to be the one who takes the time to truly understand the mechanics of why it works.
It's about developing the operational judgment needed to recognize assets that genuinely deserve your capital.
And if we really want to challenge the way we see the world based on this framework, consider this. If the absolute best, most fundamentally resilient investments are actually boring ones that solve unglamorous everyday human needs, the next time you walk down your own street, look at those mundane, unexciting buildings around you.
Yeah.
What boring everyday problems are they solving that everyone else is overlooking because they're too busy staring at the flashy new skyscraper? That might just be where the real opportunity is quietly sitting.